And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. It's July 19th, and that is actually, I think, becoming one of our theme songs, the Ballad of the Green Mountain Boys. Those were the guerrilla fighters who really sparked off the American Revolution, and one of the ways they did that, long before the first shots were ever fired at Lexington and Concord, they went into the Crown courts all over Vermont and shut them down. They burned up the mortgage records by which the lands of the farmers were being seized by these corrupt Crown officials. They shut down the courts and set up their own. And that's one of the ways that people began to learn how to govern themselves. Of course, the difference now and then is kind of severe. People had their own land base. They had their own farms to defend. And they had kind of a daily self-reliance that they lived. We have to learn to recover that. And this is one of the purposes of our shows. And I'm following the work of the Republic of Canada. You can find the work at republicofcanada.ca. And we're here, of course, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific on the BBS network. Now, over the last number of weeks and into the future, we'll be surveying the work of common law assemblies all over Canada. And that includes on Vancouver Island, around British Columbia, and in Winnipeg and Ontario. Today, I'm really privileged to have with me a good friend, Curtis Stone, who has helped organize a common law assembly in Kelowna, British Columbia, and he's an urban farmer, a free thinker, and the leader of this fight. Curtis, welcome on the show.
Hey, Kevin. It's an honor and privilege to be here.
It's good. You know, we've done a number of interviews together on your program, and so I thought it was only fitting that you come on ours. And why don't we kick off, for folks who don't know you, say something about yourself and, you know, our involvement together in this whole common law movement and what you've been doing a little bit in Kelowna.
Yeah, so I've been a commercial farmer for 10 years. I started a, kind of in the quest of my own sovereignty in a way, which is growing your own food. You know, people hear the term food sovereignty used here and there. That was really my first kind of foray into all of this stuff, really. But I, you know, found a real strong desire to grow my own food a number of years ago after the 2008 mortgage housing collapse or whatever, and found myself, got into farming. I tried to get into farming in the typical way where, you know, you go and you buy land and you do it all that way, but I didn't have those means. I didn't have any money, basically. I had some money. I worked as a tree planter in the British Columbia forest for 10 years and save some money and, you know, still have some student debt, but I didn't have any credit. You know, my parents weren't wealthy or aren't wealthy, and I had no means to buy land. So I kind of stumbled upon this urban farming thing and thought I'd give it a shot, and kind of fast forward 10 years. I'm known as the urban farmer. I've written a book about my, my adventures on my farm and how it was profitable. And I've kind of got that business model all around the world, and so I kind of found a way to be food sovereign and make a living as a farmer without owning land. And that's mostly where I started. Right. You know, I built a career as a content creator in and around agriculture, and now really a big supporter of regenerative agriculture, and kind of done a lot of that, and really have been drawn to the idea of finding liberty the whole way, just in different ways as I've gone through this journey and learned the things that I have, and started a podcast in summer of 2019 called Liberty on the Land. You've had you on more than any other guest, and really have been in this pursuit of how do we find liberty? You know, we're in this this global system now, and there's no Australia to go to anymore. You know, there's no free land to find. We have to find it within ourselves and within our own communities, and that kind of brings us to where we are with our own sort of common law assembly here in Kelowna.
Yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about that, and then, you know, we can get into a whole dialogue about some things that are really obviously important for all of us right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the idea kind of came from some of your work. You know, myself and a number of people in our group had read your books, the Common Law Training Manual, as well as the Republic of Canada, and we're fascinated by these ideas because the people in our group are, I would consider, veterans as far as, being awake, if you will, for lack of a better term. been down the rabbit hole for a long time, understand the de facto system and all this and the history of it. And we kind of came together saying, you know, well, you know, like there's been movements as of recently that have been getting some traction. At least they seem to have tapped into a cultural zeitgeist. One is your idea of the Republic of Canada. Another is this one called Unify the People. There was also a man named Doug Force out of Toronto who's got this thing called The Myth is Canada, and he's been right. talking about constitutional conventions for years. And so there seems to be a cultural zeitgeist happening right now. And yeah. enough of us have kind of tapped into it. But the thing that we've been more fascinated about with your idea with the common law, it's not necessarily your idea. You've kind of put some work into it, right? I don't mm-hmm. know if you invented the idea of the common law assembly.
No, by no means. It's just kind of
by no means. I didn't think so. And but we like the idea in the sense that there's all these things going on that seem to be outside of our control. There's some big issues that people are concerned with right now, like the 5G, the lockdowns, the endlessly encroaching totalitarian state. And so much of that, when you get hung up on every single issue that the establishment throws at you, mm-hmm. becomes overwhelming and exhausting because it's just like one issue after the next, and then you kind of feel like you're in this hamster wheel constantly. The thing that we loved about the idea of the Common Law Assembly is that we can do this now, we can do this together, and we can do something.
Yes.
And for me, like I said at the beginning, the first foray of getting into that was taking control of my food. And for me as a family man, that's very important, especially now. When I started, I didn't have children. Now I do. And so this is kind of another layer, because the way I see liberty now is a little differently than when I first kind of got into the liberty movement. You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, free men on the land, being sovereign, and there's all kinds of different processes and ways to do that. I kind of see it all like layers of an onion. And at the center of it is the man, the born free man on the land.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the person, and then there's all these layers of things that get you further from your true divinity as a man or woman on this land of God. And I think the more of these things that the more of these layers we can pull back that are within our control, the more success we'll have and the more meaning it will have in our lives. And that's what I like about growing my own food, but it's also what I like about this idea with the Common Law Assembly is that we can do this now. We don't have to mail it in, right? There's no votes, you know. Even I find that within the Unify the People movement, which has some great ideas, you know, they've written these constitutions for each province, but at the same time, it's a bit of mailing it in. It's a bit, okay, well, this constitution has been written, and you can just sign it, and that's it.
Right.
To me, that's not enough skin in the game.
Absolutely.
I think we need to get to a place where we are assuming more and more responsibility, because rights and responsibilities are intertwined, and we've continuously traded them off for the last number of hundreds of years in our society for conveniences. So give me convenience or give me death. That's sort of the motto of today, and has been for a long time. And with all of those conveniences we get from corporations, the government being one of them, we continuously lose our sovereignty. And so it's all about us looking at this Common Law Assembly as a basic lawful framework to say, okay, there are steps that we want to take to build our own governing body. And actually, in our document, we chose to call it a governing body, not a government. Mm-hmm. Governing body. Government. I've always been a little bit weird of the word government, because when you break it up in the Latin, mente is of the mind and govern is to control. So to me, I've always interpreted that word as mind control. I don't know if that's directly what it means, but...
Well, no, so it's good, because Latin is very much into questions of authority and power over others, so that's very, very astute of you to change that.
it more so is about the significance of our intentions. It's important to write these things down. It's important to say, okay, we're doing this. But you know, we had a signing ceremony for our assembly last week, and it was a magical and powerful moment where all of us involved, the 12 of us got together on a little private beach. We had a fire, and we all stood with our feet in the sand, and we all held hands, and we all read a verse or a passage of our proclamation. And it was powerful. And I think so much of what is so symbolic of what we did there is that it is the manifestation of our intentions to say we are devoted to this idea and we're devoted to creating a lawful society. And we're not going to ask permission. We're just going to do it.
Exactly. And you know, when you're saying this is really beautiful, what you're describing, Curtis, because people constantly ask us, how do you go about something? Well, the how is already written on our hearts. It's a matter of giving ourselves the permission to act. And when you say we need to do it, we also have to do it because there is no authority now in Canada. There's no courts. There's no parliament. There's an enormous power vacuum. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that, your thoughts on that. There's an opportunity now for people all over to fill the vacuum through exactly the means you're talking about, and that kind of vision. But there's got to be priorities. And some of the things, I remember we're exchanging a list of ideas for this show, and I jotted down a few things. Children, food, liberty. These are like fundamental things that should unite all of us. And within an assembly, there are going to be political differences all over the place. But the point is, there's got to be that common ground that unites us, the defense of the earth, our liberties, our children, that has to unite all of us. So why don't we kind of go into a little bit about that, what that might look like, you know, to focus on that kind of work.
Our group is well on the way to that in the sense that, well, I'm a farmer, and we actually have three other farmers in our group, so a good number of us are already significantly participating in agriculture. I guess when it comes to children, everybody in the group, I'm just trying to think, is there anyone that doesn't have kids? No. Every single member has multiple children. Mm-hmm. And we're very much connected on those values. We all value the idea of homeschooling or unschooling. Some of us, our kids are older than others. Some of us have younger children. I think as far as where that goes principally, it's an easy one to align with people, because I think especially in the political environment we're in right now, especially when you look at the sort of dumpster fire of the public education system across the world with all these lockdowns, a lot of people are thinking, you know, maybe we should just be homeschooling, because if we're going to be at home locked down anyways, what are we waiting around for? To send our kids to these crazy indoctrination camps that are more obviously indoctrinating than ever, especially when you look at all of the things that they're forcing kids to comply with, all of these disgusting social distancing laws.
Just on that, I had something I got from our group in Parksville. There's a common law assembly forming in Parksville on Central Vancouver Island, along with Couch and Bay. But they say there's a program coming in the BC school system in September called the SOGI system.
We have it here. It's an absolute Marxist social justice.
Well, it basically says you can't refer to your parents as mother or father anymore.
Yep.
And it completely removes any notion of family and everything. And,
absolutely.
You know, so I mean, let's realize that our backs are very much against the wall on this. And homeschooling is now an essential step. I mean, it's the first line of defense, and we've got to be able to defend ourselves. That leads into the whole issue of what is a common law court? What are common law sheriffs? How do we take back policing and self-defense in our communities, right? It leads into that issue directly.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, it's kind of funny. I always find correlations to agriculture, but, you know, one thing I'm in the process of developing a new farm and a farm to park on for a long time. You know, all the farming I've done so far has been relatively short term because I've always leased land, but we're looking now at purchasing a larger tract of land. One thing that I always think of when the first thing I want to get onto a piece of land is make sure certain long-term systems are in place right away. So that is the plantation of trees, of certain trees for particular purposes, mostly edible, but because those trees take a long time to grow. I think about children in the same way, is that We first have to defend the children and the minds of the child, because the propaganda machine, and you're a deep studier of history, but you know that many of these dictators throughout, you know, the communist regimes and fascist regimes, they all knew that if you get to the child before the age of seven, you can meld their mind forever.
That's an old Jesuit quote, actually.
Of course, the Jesuits are at the core of all these things, right?
Yeah.
But I recognize this, that in the most practical sense, and especially now with all of this social distancing nonsense that they're propagandizing our children with, it's very scary. And I'm at the point where I don't even really want to be around other publicly educated children, because I'm so concerned of how those kids will be an influence on mine, because they're being so indoctrinated. And the implementation of SOGI that you mentioned is actually nothing new here. SOGI has been in full force here in School District 23 in the Okanagan for a number of years. I've read through the material. A couple good friends of mine have attended their board meetings or their public hearing meetings and listened to the absolute garbage that they're teaching kids. It's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. And it's all baked with, you know, political correctness and sort of lovey-dovey stuff of let's love each other and let's be accepting of everybody, which I'm all for. But that's not the outcome, because it's endless compartmentalization of the individual. So you're divided more. It's no longer boys and girls. It's every skin color in the pigment of the human genome, and then it's every sexual orientation, which are now there's more than just one or two or three.
No,
you know,
crazy.
It's so ridiculous and it's so endlessly confusing.
And the definition of genocide, of course, when you come down to it, is you're exterminating identity, a particular identity and way of thinking and being. That's exactly what's going on. And, you know, when you said, no, I didn't invent the common law assembly idea, but my unique piece in this is that I came to it from not only having my own life destroyed by this culture, but realizing that a country that did deliberate genocide to so many children and then patted itself on the back for it, it's not going to stop with Native children. It's going to do it to everybody. And so there's an urgency that I'm bringing into this, realizing, you know, my own life is being destroyed. I've had friends murdered because of this. It's a war at home that I've always known has been going on. Now it's the alarm bell is going off for all of us, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And yeah, it's, I don't know what else to say to it.
These things are self-evident. It's a question of what you do now, right? And it's really encouraging to hear the steps you folks are making on this. One idea that somebody wrote to me from Winnipeg says, I just got this on an email. Talk more about education. What would a republic citizenship school look like? What would a free university look like in the new republic? Any thoughts on any of those?
Yeah, and you know, you and I have had sort of philosophical conversations in some of the podcasts we've done together before on this. Because, I mean, the thing for me is I come from all of this as I hate the left-right dichotomy politically. However, there are things in the libertarian philosophy, you know, more based on thinkers like Murray Rothbard and Hayek that were really into this idea of a deep liberty, in that the individual decides everything. And so, you know, when I, in my uncovering of the de facto state of Canada and my understanding of how resources are managed and how is wealth created, and you know, there's a lot of talk right now on the left about this idea of universal basic income and sort of this, we need to create, like, and then you get politicians like Bernie Sanders and stuff that have mainstreamed this idea of free education and all that stuff. And I think we have to be careful with that, because I understand that if we did build a republic, let's say that was a republic that wasn't just another government system based on the debt monetary system, right, where you're just taxing people and you're printing money through inflation, but you actually had a system that provided for people, in that if we all decided that, okay, what are we going to do if we do form this this republic, and I'll get to how this ties into education in a second, but just to set it up, is we get to that eventually. What do we do with all the crowned land? And this is one thing that I've kind of struggled with in the libertarian philosophy, or sort of the more of the Murray Rothbard thing, which is the anarcho-capitalist idea where, you know, you have basically stateless societies and you use capitalism, but more just free marketism, more like a farmer's market, you know, is a true version of,
right.
of a free market.
Well, it coincides with the left and the whole cooperative movement on the prairies. I mean,
it does.
The labels
yeah.
break down and you find this common ground, right?
Well, and that's where I'm getting here, is that if we had a republic and we were able to basically come together and say, look, all the people in this area, in this particular geographic area, for the conversation, let's just say it's the Okanagan Valley. Let's say mm-hmm. we get enough people to say, we're going to be our own nation. So what do we do with all this land that's considered the crown? Because it's not private, but none of us own it directly. Well, we say that land has resources on it, whether they be dams, energy projects, mines, forests, whatever. In a way, we nationalize. And that word, I'm mm-hmm. always, it's always dicey for me to use that word. But we basically say, well, then let's collectively share that. And so if we have a resource pool that creates value, we share that value amongst the people living on this land. And
right.
so that's where you get your sort of free things. Like we can have a society where people don't starve to death. We can have a society where those who are less fortunate, who might have been born with certain ailments or disabilities, that we can take care of those children. You know, somebody loses their family or a limb or whatever. We can take care of people who can't take care of themselves. I believe in that. I just believe the mechanisms that we've been doing it through, this debt-based slavery system, are just false ways of doing it. So if we decide, okay, we have something, I believe the best way to do this is to empower the individuals and communities to do it themselves. I don't think in a republic, at least the republic that I would like to build, there wouldn't be any central authority like a Ministry of Education. I think if we look back at history, it's too dangerous to do that. I think it should be left to individual communities to decide. And if we have a resource base to share from, as in the people of the Okanagan Nation, whatever we want to call it, have resources that are extracted and used for the benefit of all of us, and then we have the profit of those resources to share, well, then right. people will have their own resources to decide what they want to do with. And then
so
that's
you're touching a really important yeah. principle, which is really runs through our whole notion of the republic, which is decentralized control, local self-governance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
yep.
kind of a touchstone for a lot of what we do. I just got an email from somebody that says, well, what do you do if the Chinese invade? How are you going to fight them off if you're all decentralized communities?
Well, it's a big one, and I don't, you know, I've really only chased that rabbit hole for the last few months when you pointed out to me, well, actually, it wasn't you directly. I was listening to PBS radio. You had a gentleman on there, a First Nations gentleman, who was talking about FIPA, the Foreign Investment Protection Act. And then I went and read it and looked in it and was absolutely shocked. And so I don't even have my head around it entirely. I think one thing from a principle level is that if you look at the ideological subversion that has taken place in North America over the last 60 years. And I do believe China is behind it. I can't prove that, but I do believe that they are, especially when you look at a lot of things happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
The way they've done it is they have broken down sort of cultural institutions for a long time. I don't mean physical institutions like the church or whatever, I mean actual cultural institutions. Look at how political correctness has broken down the institution of the family. Maybe institution is the wrong word, but do you know what I mean? That they've mm-hmm. broken these things down. So I think we intrinsically, as Westerners, as North Americans, and you know, coming from Protestant tradition, we have a almost biological tradition of common law.
Yes.
And that we do know what's right and wrong.
That's
Whereas
right.
in China, it's a very different scenario. Very different scenario. And so I think fundamentally, with regard to that question, it is firstly we have to preserve the tradition of the common law and what is right and what is wrong.
Well, very much, and I'm glad you're touching on this, Curtis, because you know, when you look at Confucianism, which manifested not only in the emperors of China but in Maoism, it's really just a continuation, the same way Tsarism continued under Stalin. The whole notion that a state authority, or rather a wise teacher, simply teaches and you mimic it. A friend of mine was teaching a lot of Asian students in Nanaimo, and she said she'd catch them plagiarizing all the time. And they didn't understand how plagiarism was not a good idea, that you had to come up with your own thoughts, your own critical judgment.
Yeah.
They weren't raised that way. They were raised to think, well, you just write down the answer from the authority, and that's the truth. They had no notion of the whole Socratic tradition of question, answer, debate, you know, and in the common law, through trial by precedent, you know, how it's evolving. Knowledge and wisdom is constantly evolving. It doesn't come from one source. That runs diametrically opposed to, you know, this Confucianism, which is really infiltrating the culture on every level.
Oh, it absolutely has. I mean, it's similar in the Middle East, too. It's very much a Western phenomenon. And perhaps, you know, there's a lot of things that I am not proud about a Western culture. And I know you would probably share these with me. But is one of the things that I am proud about from Western culture is that Socratic method, is that that deep respect for the method of debate and thinking for oneself. You know, I got into one of the first guys that really opened my mind when I was a lot younger was Noam Chomsky. Mm-hmm. And I read his book when I was, I think it was either 16 or 18 years old. I read Manufacturing Consent that long ago.
Yep.
And it blew my mind. And it opened me into a whole new world. And, you know, there's a lot of things I disagree with on Noam Chomsky on. He's a little bit too left-wing for me. However, there are some things, especially with linguistics, that I think he's contributed to that are incredible. And in that book, he really opened my mind to how information is used to manipulate the mind. And
right.
I think we have to be so cognizant of that, especially when we look at a document like FIPA, and that document gives China basically absolute indemnity from a variety of things. Like you pointed out in your episode that I listened to, Article 33, and that's the one that I spent the most time on in a recent podcast I did with myself, where I kind of dissected a bunch of Canadian acts and statutes. But there's other elements of that act which give China all kinds of protections from the media. So China can do all kinds of sketchy things with energy projects. They can commit environmental atrocities, and the government of Canada has to put hush orders
right.
on the media about China. And I've already caught the CBC doing this multiple times, covering up China.
Well, absolutely, and it gets even more sinister when we look at the role and the actual disappearances of whole swaths of native families from Northern British Columbia on the Highway of Tears. You know, we had Merv Ritchie, a journalist, was on our show a number of times, and he found the hard evidence that the Chinese were operating death squads with the RCMP, and that when the federal government sent up their bogus missing women's inquiry, in their mandate, just like another Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in the mandate it said RCMP officers are not to be interviewed because they had the hard evidence on the ground that their fellow officers were killing off native families. Right, and this is happening as we speak right now. So, you know, the person's question about how do you deal with the Chinese, it's a real issue. But, I mean, it's the old question of if you have people locally organized, confident in their abilities, you know, and you have that kind of guerrilla movement from the base. Well, look, America couldn't defeat that kind of guerrilla movement in Vietnam, and China's not going to be able to defeat it here if there's enough people organized at the base. And I think that's the whole point of what we're doing.
Absolutely. And you know what? You have to also, you know, you often quote Sun Tzu in The Art of War, which is important, especially because of the historical connection to China and Chinese warfare. However, in the modern world, and I'm not an expert on China, and, you know, I've looked at kind of the trends of what's happening. I could be wrong about this, but when I look at least what the media information I can access on the surface, China doesn't really seem to be militarizing the world their militarist or their colonialist tactic, if you will, is more subversive.
Right.
And, you know, even guys, you know, a guy like Steve Bannon, who gets a lot of criticism, and rightfully so, but he's done a fairly good job of breaking down and showing the warfare that China has been engaging for a number of years, and that has been economic, information, and economic information and cultural. They're completely using subversive tactics, which come right out of a long history of Soviet systems.
Well, and don't forget, related to that, is the fact that they are masters of Sun Tzu philosophy, which is when you face a bigger opponent, you get them to destroy themselves. You don't confront them directly.
Exactly.
America has the biggest military. There's a thing in the news now about all these potential clashes between the Chinese and American Navy in the South China Sea. There's two carrier fleets that are heading there right now. So, like with that, America used the same strategy with the Soviet Union. You get them to spend themselves, over-militarize, and destroy their own economies that way. That worked in the Soviet Union. Now China's employing the same strategy against America, and unfortunately it's working.
It's working incredibly well.
You know, and so now geopolitically it makes sense. They're the rising power. America's going down. If we were their rulers, we'd probably be doing exactly the same thing from a point of view of just self-interest. But we have to understand what's behind all this, and Canada is the ball being tossed between all these superpowers again, like we always have been historically.
Yeah.
But for that reason alone, it gives us a chance to create a new, or finally, for the first time, to create an identity of what it does it mean to be Canadian or Canadian or whatever you want to call it. But we haven't been able to get out from under this notion of crown, that English common law equals the crown. We've got to sever that, because common law had nothing to do with the crown originally. It had to do with, I mean, you mentioned Magna Carta. Section 61 of Magna Carta gives people the right to seize crown land as reparations if the crown has harmed you. It's right there in Section 61 of Magna Carta. So this beautiful thing about our English common law tradition is it empowers the people along the lines you were talking about. And we need to turn that into a political reality now, not just a personal one.
Absolutely. And so much of the fight, if you will, and I don't really want to think about it in terms of fighting, but just for lack of a better word, is we have been completely surrounded from generations of propaganda of the mind.
Yep.
You know, ultimately, it almost is a war of the mind more than anything else, because if we can get our heads around what it means to be free and then start to unpack that, but then also start to implement that in our day-to-day lives, we can create. The way I've actually been envisioning it lately, Kevin, is kind of like grass in the concrete. So you ever see on a sidewalk, if it's like an unmaintained part of a city, and dust blows into the cracks, and then seeds find their way in there, and they germinate, and they eventually, the roots grow through the bottom of the concrete, they root themselves, and if you leave a sidewalk unmaintained for a number of years, it will disappear very quickly. So the way I see it now is, because there's no new colony, there's nowhere left to go. So we have to be internal, but also within the communities around us. We have to be like grass in the concrete. And I think it's the only path to a new form of regeneration, where we have to accept that this whole colonialist system has engulfed us and it's around us. But I actually truly believe that it is mostly in our minds, because if you really break it down philosophically, what is all this government stuff? What is it?
Mostly fiction.
It is. It's especially when you actually read the documents, you can find that, because it's all there. It's on these things that they refer to as territorial waters and foreshore and seabed and internal waters, and all those things are fluid, right? And in a way that makes them fiction, because in the legal statute system, everything is all corporate fictions, right? Including the person and the corporation and the native band, and all of these things are just corporate fictions. So it is a world of illusion.
And very much.
If we can really start to just get our heads around that and then start to work with things in reality, the problem is that the temptations are so great. In that, you know, as I said when I started, we continuously trade conveniences in exchange for rights and responsibilities. And the conveniences are so great. So, you know, one might make the argument, like I am, where I say, you know, well, we want to grow our own food. We want to be first food sovereign. But it's just so easy and convenient to go to the grocery store and buy everything you need. So why would I be food sovereign when I can get everything I need? Or, you know, you might say, well, we want to start making our own things, like whatever it be. We want to make tools. We want to have our own fab labs where we create things. Oh, but you can just go to the hardware store and get
That'll,
you
know, that's the enemy. Yeah.
It is. Curtis, it is the enemy. The enemy is all around us. It's completely all-encompassing.
Curtis, I had a question from Ontario. Talk a little bit what a common law court would look like, and our folks in Kelowna trying to set that up. Just preceding that, I wanted to mention that, you know, we've talked before about, and in the common law training manual that you mentioned, there's a 12-step procedure for how to set one up. But there's a simpler, more direct way to do it. And when you form a common law assembly, the assembly itself can function as a court, because what do you want to do with people? You want them to work out their differences and their disputes directly, so you don't have another layer of bureaucracy of government, like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So you invite people into the assembly to work out their disputes and use it as a way to do that. And don't forget, traditionally, any assembly governing body is also considered a court. So it's for dispute resolution. And if, you know, even though you may have just 12 people right now, you can start doing that. If you start meeting regularly and two farmers have a problem, come into the assembly, we'll work it out with you. And that way you don't have to think, oh, how do I build a whole structure of a court? We can do it directly in the assembly. What are your thoughts about that kind of method?
Well, I love it because it's practical. It's something you can do in the short term. You have to have people sign in. You know, like one of the things that we're in the process of doing now is we have our proclamation, and we like our proclamation for the most part. I think it will evolve over time, but it's good enough to move forward. And so what we're doing right now is we're creating, you know, a bunch of us, most of us in our assembly are actually entrepreneurs, which is always the delight to work with. Because entrepreneurs have a tendency just to get shit done. And so we kind of looked at this thing as, okay, well, we want to get the idea out to people. We're not ready to go mass market. We're not going to have a website or anything like that. I know people are probably going to be asking, well, how can I join? But it's really for locals at this point. But we're creating a one-pager. So that's a marketing term where, you know, you've got a product or an idea, and you've got, you know, mountains of paperwork on research and development and all kinds of things. I'm involved in the tool creation business as well, so I've been involved in prototyping and R&D and all these things. And you have so many things about a particular product or thing you want to sell, but what you really got to do to get money behind it, or in this case it's not money, but get people behind it, is you got to have a simple way of describing what it is. And so we're calling that our one pager. It's basically like a synopsis for a book. You know, you write a book, and then your publisher says, give me a synopsis, which might just be a few paragraphs. And so that's what we're doing, is a way to get people in. And then from there, we're hoping that we can get more people into it to increase the level of engagement, and then those things will kind of come naturally. I think our goal is to have, you know, a number of, if we could get 200 people into this assembly in Kelowna, I think we would have a significant movement, because it's not so much the number. Like, you know, there's 180,000 people in Kelowna. There's quite a few. But 200 people in anything is significant, especially if they're committed. And this is the principal idea that I love about the Common Law Assembly, is that it isn't just signing a piece of paper and saying you're part of it. It requires certain things. It requires coming to regular meetings. It requires participating. And I think that idea of what you expressed there with using it as a form of local judicial or way to settle disputes, mm-hmm. is a fantastic one. Because ultimately, each of us need to be accountable to one another. But the biggest challenge is the fact that we're swimming in an ocean of convenience. And so we have to really get people. It's like it's so much resistance to temptation. I think that's going to be our greatest challenge going forward.
Now, talking about Sun Tzu, here I thought I'd throw a quote in, which I think is very important. It's kind of a basic maxim for people in our situation. Do not respond to the ground your enemy has prepared for you, but instead shape their ground. Then they have no alternative but to be led by you as if it was their own idea. And, you know, the case I always use on that is we began to use the word genocide 20 years ago. Now even the prime minister is using it because you take mm-hmm. back the language, you take back the energy or the chi of the situation. And his other point that flows right out of that as a corollary is the fact that you cannot rely on a mass of people for victory. You have to rely on seasoned veterans who lead the rest in their wake. And that's the key in organizing. It isn't a matter of just appealing to everyone, because most people aren't in a position where they're able to act, let alone imagine acting in this way. But there's a few of us who are, and it's always that minority of cadre who lead the rest, okay?
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And so, you know, it's organizing those veterans. That's what's key to success in any situation, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, another thing occurred to me is, as you just said that, one thing that I love about the idea so much as well is that it's just proactive. You know, we have been in an endless struggle. I've been, you know, moderately involved in political activism since I was like 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was a real Chomskyite and more of a left winger when I was younger, and really still believed in the political process because I didn't know anything about it. Everything in political activism today is always about standing against things. Mm-hmm. It's always going, oh, we're going to stop this bill from being passed, or we got to stop 5G, we got to stop forced vaccinations, or whatever the issue of the day is.
By asking for something.
Exactly. It's by signing some petition, which is just a form of begging to your masters. The idea of the Common Law Assembly is that we are our own masters. We are the creators. We are going to create this thing within the system, but we're essentially going to try to ignore it as best as we can, because it just feels better to be proactive in life than to be against something. To be pro than to be against.
It's creative, and you said it so perfectly well. It reminds me of reading about when I was young and very involved in civil disobedience. I still am, but in a different way now. But you know, reading Gandhi, reading Thoreau and Tolstoy, their whole notion in Gandhi's famous quote that we will never have political independence from the British Empire if we do not first have soul independence within ourselves, and the idea is, What protest really is you withdraw. You withdraw your energy from a system and create your own. And within yourself and then outwards. And the power of even a few people doing that, it's demonstrated time and again in history, right? That we create that new energy, and the whole system, the minute a few people start doing that, it starts tottering. Because it doesn't know how to deal with that kind of example. It can't control it. It can only intimidate people and try to scare them to get them back into, you know, reattaching. I often think that, you know, when people call me up and they say, oh, have you seen what Trump has done now to help people? That's what people used to say about Obama, right? Obama was kind of the way to keep left-wing people looped into the system, and now Trump is a way to keep right-wing people looped into the system. But the point is, they're all making the same mistake. It doesn't matter what somebody who calls himself a ruler does. He's not going to do anything for us. We have to do it for ourselves. Right, and that's an amazingly simple lesson, yet it seems so hard for people. That's a whole other discussion, I guess.
It's worth touching on, because I do find it's kind of the elephant in the room for the most part. Is there is this QAnon phenomenon within the truther community, and there's Trump, and I've gone down that rabbit hole. Like I've looked at that stuff, and it's just, to me, it seems like such a perfect Pied Piper type of operation, that you basically just co-opted all the people that would be the largest people to stand against.
Because,
when George Bush was president, there was a lot of right wingers that did not support him, and it was the same with Clinton too. When Bill Clinton was president in the United States, a lot of the anti-establishment people were a lot more united then.
Yeah.
And then Obama did an amazing job, as you pointed out, of and the reason I'm using the U.S. as a reference, I know Canadians will often go, why do you guys spend so much time talking about the U.S.? Well, the reason is because they are the cultural leaders of the Western world. And so whatever norm that they put on in mm-hmm. American culture is reflected here. And so it's always worth mentioning that. But I see it in the whole Trump phenomenon. And, you know, it really drives me crazy, actually.
I like the quote
because
from...
Because I see all these people losing their minds over this stuff.
There was a guy, Eugene Debs. He ran for the Populist Party in the early part of the 20th century. He actually ran for U.S. president from inside a prison and got 2 million votes, which I thought was good. He had this amazing... The populist movement was uniting all the people, farmers, workers, against the interests, as they call them, right? Big banks, big government, the whole bit, big corporations. And Eugene Debs said in a rally once to people, I will not be a Moses to lead you into a promised land, because if I could lead you in, I could lead you out again. And that is just so beautiful. It sums up, you are the ones who've got to do it. Nobody else is going to do it for you. And that requires growing up. And people don't like to grow up. It means taking responsibility. We're used to being children. We're used to being slaves. And yet now it's time, people, for everyone to grow up. And this is what this show is aimed at, those people willing to take that step, really, how to do
it. Yes, well, absolutely. And that's where I'm in. That's why I'm 100% behind the idea. I just think that it's a... especially going back to the whole Trump phenomenon, it's just, you know, what, maybe there is some truth to the whole thing. I don't know. I'm going to bet not, because every politician I've ever put faith in my entire life has been a complete and utter letdown. But anytime I hear a movement say things like "trust the plan," which is sort of one of the slogans of the QAnon movement, it's basically saying, yeah, you can just continue to sit on your ass while we solve all these problems for you.
We've solved it for you. Yeah,
it's BS.
It's a priest or a politician. A priest or a politician knows that they have to say what people need to hear, right?
Yeah,
it's that simple. And
well, so, I think so much of this comes back to sort of religious principles in a way, which you're far more versed in than I am, and I have this sort of philosophy. You can tell me what you think of it. Is that I believe that the second coming of Christ is actually us, and I'm not nearly as versed in the Bible as you, not even close. But I really believe that we're at a point, because what I believe spiritually is that we're all part of the Creator, and we're all divine, and we're all part equally of God, and God wants us to grow up. God wants us to recognize our true power. And we can't recognize our true power until we realize our true power and we use it. And that is to create. It is not to just stand by idly and vote for the next asshole to screw it up. It's to actually get off our butts and make things happen. And it, and what I love so much about the idea of the Common Law Assembly is that it's not about getting off your butt to march in the streets or sign a petition or scream at people on social media. It's to actually create, because I think fundamentally God is creation, and we are a part of that creation until we start realizing that in order to make something change, we have to create. We actually have to step into that role of creator. Well, not just vote for it and ask for it.
Any of us who've had children know how simple that is and how beautiful, natural a thing that is, right? To sit on the earth with your children, everything is clear. You know exactly what you need to do. That's what common law is, common reason, right? Which we're all born with, and that's who we rely on in each other. We've got about 5 minutes left. And I very much want to carry this on with you. Like, we can get into all sorts of areas that are very important to be talking about. But I wanted to ask you if you have any kind of final words that you want to sum up about what you're doing, or, you know, if you want to give contact info or anyone in the Kelowna area or anything like that.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I think what I'd like to finish with is, you know, one of the things that even in our group that we've had to kind of get our heads around is there's so much of this stuff where, like, say you take a document, like a Declaration of Independence, a Mayflower. We've called ours a Proclamation of Independence. We all like the words proclamation. Even when we were drafting this document, there was, like, because a lot of our group are actually veterans who understand syntax and have, you know, been down the legalese rabbit hole and all that. We've got copies of Black's Law Dictionary, and we've used the Oxford Dictionary as the basis of our language. And so in the front of our proclamation, we say that all of our language in here is referenced in we're in common law jurisdiction, and we reference the Oxford Dictionary. But one thing people need to understand is that it isn't about doing things right as you've thought of them in the past. So when it comes to writing a document like your own foundational document for a common law assembly, it isn't about the specific language you use. Oh, don't use that word because then you're going to get into jurisdiction this way, or don't use that word. That doesn't matter. The important thing is you are the creators. You are creating this document. You are coming together as divine men and women to put your oath and intentions on paper. You decide what the terms are. It's up to you. It isn't about, oh, if you use this word, then if you go into a court, forget their courts, forget their system. That's right. Their system. The crown, all of that, that's the fictional world of the de facto state, the crown, the Vatican, all of that nonsense. Yep. You are creator. You are divine. You are powerful. You decide exactly what you want to do. And all those little details don't matter. People get so hung up on syntax and language, but it's like, then just write in your document. Okay, like we did. That's why we just decided we're just going to say all words in this, unless otherwise specified, we're using the Oxford Dictionary. So whenever we use the word person in our document, we're not talking about a legal person. We're talking about the Oxford definition of a person, which is just is a man or a woman. It's that right. Simple. And once we kind of all got our heads around that, we found it quite empowering. So I kind of wanted to leave people with that, because it doesn't matter all of those details.
Yeah.
Just start doing it and know that you are the creators of that document. You're not in anybody else's jurisdiction. And you can state that right at the beginning. We did. We stated right at the beginning. One of the first sentences was that we are in common law jurisdiction. All words are referenced to the Oxford Dictionary.
Absolutely. It's soul power, really. It's giving a rebirth to something that's been lying dormant for so long in people. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful, Curtis. I want to thank you for being on today and for carrying on, with the example in Kelowna and everything you're doing. And we want to have you back on soon. Any contact info? Do you want to give? Do you have a...
To be honest, for people to reach out to me, I mean, people can find me on my website, The Urban Farmer. Just so people know, I mean, I get 50 emails a day. And so I'd love to help everybody. I would say if you're local, you can track me down. Right now, you know, we're not ready to take our, you know, I'm very much a global guy. You know, I have I've been all over the world with my work and stuff, but as far as our common law assembly goes, like, we're really just trying to stay local. What our goal is really following a permaculture slogan, which is think globally, act locally.
Good.
And so we have a greater mission and context, but first we want to make things happen locally. And, you know, I've already told some surrounding groups in the Okanagan, hey, you can take our proclamation and do whatever you want to it and make it
Excellent.
Your own.
Well, good. We've got to go now, Curtis. We're running out of time, but I want to thank you for being on. We'll carry this on in the future. Thank you so much, brother.
My pleasure, Kevin.
Okay. Talk soon.
Take care.
Curtis Stone from Kelowna, part of the initiative behind the Common Law Assembly there. People want more information, please go to our website. It's up now, thanks to some folks back east in our movement. It's republicofcanada.ca. And write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com. In the future, we're going to be having more of these kinds of discussions and reports, including updates from Vancouver Island, Toronto, and Winnipeg, activities being planned there. And again, take this to heart, brothers and sisters. Actually, what Curtis was saying sounded amazingly like sermons I used to give in Port Alberni. So the neat thing about these assemblies, it brings together a great meeting of minds and souls of people yearning to be free and especially fighting for the next generation. The fate of our children are in our hands right now, as has been described. This is no like matter. This is a matter of a war to the death, friends. We live in a culture of murder, mass murder, and it's aimed at all of us. It always has been. It's been hitting others besides us, and now it's affecting all of us. So now is the time to unite for our own survival. We're ending on a good song, Farewell to the Crown, another one of our theme songs. We'll be back here live next week. Stay strong, stay clear. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Boys. I thank you.